part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Devro Teapag in Danville, Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur, EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont, and Citizen Sandwich and Convenience, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program this afternoon, a look at American Indian education from the time of the arrival of European settlers to the present. Our guests are the authors of the history, American Indian Education, John Rayner and Jeannie Eder. They say the legacy of linguistic and cultural repression remains with us today. We'll take a look back through history and discuss the situation today. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number 333-9455, 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, if it would be a long-distance call, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guests. John Rayner is professor of education at Northern Arizona University Flagstaff. He has taught on the Navajo Reservation and served as a school superintendent, or a school administrator, excuse me, for many Native communities. Jeannie Eder, a member of the Dakota Sioux, is director of the Alaska Native Studies Program and associate professor of history at the University of Alaska. Professors Eder's and Rayner's book, American Indian Education, A History, is published by the University of Oklahoma Press. 333-9455, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Eder, Professor Rayner, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Thank you for inviting.
Would it be accurate to say that following the period of genocide and removal, that the education of American Indians has been guided by a belief in assimilation, and to what extent does that continue today?
It has gone back and forth during the Franklin Roosevelt's administration. It moved a little away from assimilation, and they did some bilingual education. But largely, yes, it's been assimilation, and it's still, we have this anti-bilingual movement in California, Arizona, and Massachusetts that fits right into this assimilationist methodology going on today. And
Yeah. Professor Eder, in the book, the two of you note that trying to immerse students in an English environment often led to cultural disintegration. Talk with us, if you would, about the efforts to assimilate Native peoples, what that has meant for those peoples individually and collectively.
Well, I think it means that, a form of destruction of the culture to assimilate is a forced acceptance of another person's values. That's kind of my perception of the word assimilation. So when you're forced to accept another culture's values, then you lose your own, and that becomes cultural genocide.
Mm.
And so it's and that's continuing to happen in. And what has happened over the generations is that it's created a division among the Native indigenous peoples themselves. Those who have been, have accepted the assimilation have come to view it as the best way to do things, and therefore feel that it's not progressive to then teach anything about the cultural, their own native cultural values. So you get the divide and conquer mentality has been, let's say, successful in that way in terms of dividing native people and in that way bringing down some of the cultural values.
Hmm. You advocate what you call an English plus education. What does that mean?
Well, students, to be successful in this country, basically need English. No one that I know of that's advocating the continuation of Indian cultures and the revitalization of their languages is saying not to learn English, but in a sense of having a strong sense of identity, which is important to persist and be resilient in life, you also have to have a strong sense of where you came from, that to not have the idea that tradition is the enemy of progress, which was a sign on one of the Indian schools and sort of the assimilationist idea. So we're saying, and there have been schools that have been very successful at this, that have taught the native language but also had a strong English and math and science curriculum. The Hawaiian program right now with Native Hawaiians is doing that very successfully.
Bilingual education, you mentioned that a moment ago. It's an issue throughout the United States. I imagine, as you mentioned, Professor Rayner, they're more in the Southwest than anywhere else in the U.S. And, you know, there have been calls for English-only laws and laws restricting bilingual education. How is this affecting American Indian education? Haven't we come to a point where, don't we all kind of, aren't we all on the same page here in terms of there is a value of language, of our native languages, and the languages of the first Americans?
Well, 30 years ago, my wife's Navajo, and she was reprimanded by her school administrators teaching kindergarten for using Navajo words with her kindergarten students who were just learning English, and she was trying to explain this as an English and Navajo, and she got written up for violating state law. They changed that state law in the middle 70s, but now with this Proposition 203, which is similar to Proposition 227, we have that a new law, and the Window Rock schools, which is trying to do this Navajo and English, are being told by the state superintendent of education in Arizona that they're again violating state law and that they should go to all English in the primary grades with Navajo students.
And I think that one of the things that's missing in all of this is the perception that Native peoples are like other minority groups. We're really not. We have a legal relationship with the federal government that is totally different than any of the other minority groups in this country. We have certain self-governing rights. So we do have the rights to preserve our language and our traditions in our own way. And I think that that's forgotten, and it certainly isn't taught in history books, and a lot of educators and state legislators don't understand that legal relationship. So that creates some problems.
How did the civil rights movement that followed the Second World War affect Native Americans and American Indian education?
Well, right after the Second World War, they tried to terminate Indian tribes and reservations and the special relationship that Dr. Eder just talked about. And then in the late 60s and early 70s, the civil rights movement ended termination and moved towards what the current government policy of self-determination, and led to the Indian Education Act of 1972 and similar, and some studies that said that, you know, this English-only approach, assimilation approach, was not working with kids. It was that the kids were not doing well under it. So it had a very positive effect, I think.
Yeah. When did American Indians gain suffrage? This was pretty surprising to me to realize. I had never known this before, that Some American Indians didn't have the right to vote until after World War II in South Dakota, New Mexico, and Arizona.
Well, that was actually the law itself was in 1924, and I'm losing my train of thought here, but even though they had the law that says that Native people had the right to vote, their states did certain things to prevent the Native vote from becoming all-powerful or more powerful, and part of that is redistricting in states. And in Montana itself, the Crow tribe had to sue because of violation of their voting rights, and that was in the 1980s. And even in Alaska today, you know, we're looking at similar issues of Native people's vote being somehow kept down. Mm. And, you know, we don't live in a perfect world.
There were literacy requirements and ownership of land type in Arizona that kept them from voting until the 1950s. The Indians lived on the reservations. And if you look at there's strange makeup of counties in Arizona where they're very long and thin, and they would run the counties up into the reservation and try to divide and conquer, split the vote, or in other ways. Of course, now with the tremendous increase on Indian population in Arizona, that has backfired. Where the whites in these little section of a county used to control things, now the Indians control it in their section.
Hmm. Tell us more about the situation in Alaska.
Well, it's such a huge state. I've only been here for 3 years, and I'm really learning a lot. And even the land issues here haven't been totally resolved. And so Alaska really is newly colonized, I like to say. Since the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971, that is where I see the beginning of the colonization for the Native peoples of Alaska. So really, they've only had about 30 years to deal with these things.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to then envision the fact that Native villages are so isolated up here that it's hard to, get out the vote when, you know, just the counting of votes and such is so distant.
Mm-hmm.
And Alaska's one-fifth the size of the United States. And so if you can think of remote Native villages, even getting votes counted is difficult.
Mm. What are the schools like there today in those isolated communities?
I think the schools are you have good schools and you have not so good schools as you do anywhere else. I think that the No Child Left Behind legislation needs to have some exceptions up here in Alaska. Because what does a village do whose school doesn't meet the standard? You know, do they fly their children to the next village, mm-hmm. 200 miles away? You know, it doesn't make sense up here. And even though we've had the Secretary of Education come up here, I think that there really needs to be some more discussion on No Child Left Behind Act and how it impacts the Native students up here.
Yeah. What do you think of the No Child Left Behind Act, Professor Rayner?
Well, you know, it's sort of a one-size-fits-all. They have one-room high schools in those villages. You can't get highly qualified teachers to teach in all the areas that you need in a high school. It is telling schools to flunk kids that don't meet arbitrary standards on testing. All the research on Indian Ed out of the Indian Nations at Risk Task Force in 1992 says that if you flunk kids, you create dropout. So there's some real problems. You don't want to lower standards for kids, but at the same time, if they come in with smaller vocabularies in kindergarten, out of houses impacted by poverty, where there are not books in the home and where the parents didn't read to them, they're not going to meet the same level as the middle-class suburban kid, and they need time to catch up. And I don't think time failing the student and running them through a grade again is the way for them to catch up. All the research says that tends to create dropouts.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to generalize into talk about what makes school a good experience for American Indian students?
Well, I'd like to say that one of the things that makes school good is a good teacher.
Hmm.
Someone who likes the student, or somehow that the student can say, gee, that teacher likes me. And for that teacher, they work very hard. And I know that that has been a real plus for a lot of Native students who have been successful. They just say, wow, it was one teacher. It was one person who encouraged me. And I think that that's really needed.
Yeah, that's universal, isn't it?
Right.
And good teachers learn about their students and their background, or come from the same background. I went out on the Navajo Reservation as a junior high teacher in 1971, and I didn't know anything about the students. And luckily, they had just opened the first Indian tribal college down the road, so I was able to go take some courses and learn about where my students were coming from and try to adapt my curriculum so I could bring things from their culture and their history and their background into the classes, as well as the general textbook stuff that, you know, was prescribed by the state of Arizona. That's that plus. It's not just English plus, but, you know, you want to broaden kids' horizons, but you want to build a strong foundation in their own community. And one of the things is we've got grandparents that can't talk to their grandchildren and pass on family values because the grandparents speak only Navajo here in Arizona, and the grandchildren speak only English because of what the schools and this assimilationist education has done. And when I came out in 1970 and most of the kids in the early 70s still spoke Navajo, I didn't have any disciplines and troubles and stuff in the classroom because they had been taught to respect their elders. Now in the same community, they have gangs and drive-by shootings because of the breakdown in the traditional culture and sort of a replacement of it with MTV culture instead of, I think, what some of the conservatives want that are pushing English only. And
yeah. Maybe you would tell us about how some of these issues came home to you some years ago at a conference on bilingual education in Alaska, and you picked up a card where there were a listing of values and what we hold near and dear to us in this culture. Talk with us about that. Tell us about that experience.
It was an Alaska Native bilingual conference, and I keep the card in my wallet. You know, a lot of schools now are pushing self-esteem, and one of the values of that card, pulling it out of my wallet right now, was humility, that praising kids too much spoil them. It used to be thought that kids that were in, juvenile delinquents in prison had low self-esteem, and now the research shows that it's just the opposite. They have an exaggerated sense of who they are. But, yeah, the listing was knowledge of language, sharing, respect for others, cooperation, respect for elders. And, you know, I taught in a white school before I went to the Navajo Reservation, and I quit because of the behavior of the kids. Love for children, hard work, knowledge of family tree, avoidance of conflict, respect for nature, spirituality, humor, family roles, hunter success, and of course this is from up north where you don't do much farming, Arctic Circle, domestic skills, humility, responsibility to tribe. I couldn't argue with any of those values for my kids, but these were the, you know, in that tradition is the enemy of progress, and the assimilationist push that there was nothing of a value in Indian culture, so that was, you know, pushed for over a century in the government schools. There's a conflict there, and something was destroyed in those assimilationist efforts among many kids, that went through those schools that was a positive value, and sometimes it got replaced adequately, but a lot of times it didn't.
And a lot of times, when you think about it, an entire generation of Native people were removed from the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in Alaska, that is noted when they were removed to the lower 48. Some of these children were removed at the age of 6, not to return again until the age of 18. If you've recently seen that movie, what is it called, The Rabbit Fence, about the Australian children who run away from such a setting, that's been repeated time after time in the Native people of this country. And we need to realize that when you remove an entire generation, you've removed that connection to the Native culture. And so we have to rebuild that generation and help to go back to that, because we're really in generational trauma at this point.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I found myself thinking about reading American Indian Education, Your History. The time spent away from homeland, from community, in mission schools and government boarding schools, for example. What was it like to return home? Was home the same? Who were you after spending time away from your people?
Well, we looked at a lot of biographies and autobiographies of Indian people that did that, of all the ones we could find. And it was a shock because you learn to live in a certain way in a dorm, and you know, to eat off a table with silverware and stuff, and you go back home, and of course, and you were sort of told by the school, go back and teach your parents about what it means to be civilized and better. Well, parents don't like to be taught by their kids. It split families. The Pauline Gacy Kwayawama, in her autobiography, she was Hopi on No Turning Back. It caused great pain and lots of disruption within the community, I think.
Yes, for sure. I have. Some of my staff here have been to boarding schools, and they've recently did a healing ceremony of returning to those boarding schools that are no longer running. But it was very traumatic for them to look back at their childhood and realize what they had lost in being disconnected from their villages, and yet they have returned to stay in Alaska and to try and make a difference, make some changes more, so that other children, that their own children and grandchildren, don't have to have that experience that's so traumatized them.
Yeah. When did the boarding schools close down?
They still open.
They are, really?
But they are run, they have Indian school boards now and have a lot of control. Not a lot of them have closed down, but there's four or five. Sherman Institute in California, Fort Wingate in New Mexico, Flandreau in South Dakota.
Chamawa
in Oregon, but they have made a lot of changes. Now they tend to pull students in that from families where dysfunctional families and stuff, where there isn't a good home environment for the kids. I think they have more students. Most of the students that come from families that have it together go to school closer to home. And there's a few places on the Navajo Reservation where the roads get too muddy in the winter and stuff, and so there's boarding dorms and boarding schools. My wife went to stayed at the dorm at Winslow, Arizona, which is still open, and there's a dorm in Flagstaff from which the kids attend public schools.
Yeah. I wonder, Professor Eder, if in Alaska there would be some value to boarding school today, given the isolation and, you know, just the tiny numbers of students in the villages. Would there be some value for some students to go away to school? I don't know. It's a tough issue, isn't it?
Well, it really is. Certainly, there are still students who go to Chamawa. But still, it's, you know, like John said, it's those who perhaps need a more stable environment. But in reality, they come back to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And the subsistence lifestyle here and the kind of village life they have can't be found anywhere else in the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, tourists come here to see this place. And tourists love to see this environment and this kind of lifestyle. So why would Native people want to leave it, you
right.
know? So, and they're not going to leave it. They're going to stay here and do what they can. It's what I remind people is that in Alaska, Alaska Natives are the third largest employer in the state of Alaska.
Hmm.
And they're ones that we should be looking at and educating because they're going to stay.
Hmm.
You know, we don't know how long the oil companies will be here. But we know that Alaska Natives will always be here.
Jeannie Eder, a member of the Dakota Sioux, is director of the Alaska Native Studies Program and associate professor of history at the University of Alaska. She's one of our guests here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. Also with us, John Rayner. He is a professor of education at Northern Arizona University Flagstaff. Together, they are the authors of American Indian Education, A History. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us in Charleston on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Good program. I like to address your program today as microcosmic. You know, it indicates the Native or original Americans who came from somewhere, but still, it represents a microcosm in my mind to the macrocosm that that colonialism, both ancient and modern, has visited upon indigenous peoples. Without sounding repetitive, I hope that aspect of the discussion should be alluded to in some form. I think of the English, you know, they popped in my mind immediately because it was mainly the English who came here first. You know, there was the Hudson's Bay Company and all those, but still to stay, the English, I think, represented the king's colonialism and their hatred of indigenous peoples, and then translate that in a macrocosm all over the world, and the present situation in Iraq, you know, that says, in Mr. Bush's words, we are going to deliver you freedom and democracy, you know, and then we got to reflect on the sort of freedom and democracy that we have in this country, where as so far, people like myself can speak up and others. When the day comes we can't do that, then we will have drifted into tyranny as well. But to think that Iraq is going to be any more than the situation in Alaska is going to change if we have a bourgeois class that is implanted over the top of everyone else. I'll hang up and listen, and thank you very much.
Thoughts?
Well, you know, I watch our soldiers beating down doors in Iraq and yelling at the you know, mothers and children in English, and you know that they're not understanding. And a lot of teachers went out on reservations and up in Alaska villages and tried to teach kids in English when the kids did not understand the language at all, and it creates real problems. And, you know, what is culturally acceptable and what types of behavior? And if you want people to respond positively to you, how do you treat them? How do you be respectful? And that kind of, you know, if we want to bring something of our civilization because we think it's so good, and there's this problem of ethnocentrism that, you know, they think their culture is so good. How do we need to learn more, I think, about the culture that we're going into if we want to have any chance of success. And I think, so there is some parallelism there, I think.
Well, I think that's a pretty big question myself. I don't know, as you know, we could go on and on about that one. So I think John has made good enough comments for me on that one.
Let's talk with another listener then. Listener in Normal on line one. Hello.
Hi. I hope that what I'm going to say relates somewhat to the conversation, but one of the best books I've ever read is called The Education of Little Tree by Forrest Carter. It has to do with a little Indian boy and his story. It's just a wonderful, wonderful book. I don't know if your guests are familiar with it or if you are.
Oh, yeah. I got in trouble. I assigned it to my Introduction to Native American Studies course before I found it's a really good book, but it was written by segregationist aide to, was it Governor Wallace in Georgia? And so even though it says it's a true story, it's not quite true. But
I see.
But the values in it and what it teaches and the humor is certainly, I like the book, but it's not as authentic as one would like to, believe.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Has the experience of Indigenous peoples been different elsewhere in the hemisphere, in Canada, in Mexico?
You know, even within the United States, there's big differences between... You know, some Indians were permanently removed for their homeland, some were temporarily removed, and so there's big differences in the United States in the experiences and how they responded to schools, but there are also similarities, and I think worldwide, you know, almost every country in the world has Indigenous minorities, and they have shared some of this experience of colonialism and having been suppressed by a dominant group. In Iraq, the Kurds, for example, are a minority group within. So there are similarities and there are differences, and you need to be very careful in drawing generalizations, because the minute you try to generalize, the term American Indian, is an artificial term for various tribes with very much differences. And the Aboriginal people in Australia, there's 200 different languages just in the United States. And, of course, the minute you go from a different language and a different culture. So lots of similarities, lots of differences.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. Hi, your guest spoke of the language issues, and that made me think of, made me wonder if there might be differences in terms of other content areas or ways of teaching that they've observed, different influences on things like math instruction or social studies or science.
Well, I have another book, which...
I was hoping you'd mention that one, John. That's a good one.
From University of Oklahoma, 1992, Teaching American Indian Students. And there's a chapter on learning styles by Karen Swisher, who's the president of the Haskell Indian Nations University in Kansas, and Donna Diley at the University of Utah. And you need to be very careful. Some people have sort of said this is genetic, and I don't think so. But kids learn to learn differently in different homes. There is some, I think, support that culturally a lot of Indian kids learn to, they observe and watch and hold back until they feel confident to try something. where, quote, mainstream kids, they're taught to experiment and try it out and see if it works. And so there are different approaches to learning, and there could be culturally from home. And it's very interesting. I think teachers really need to be good teachers, not just learn about where their kids are coming from, but observe their kids closely in the classroom and to see how they're responding and adjust their teaching style to fit what they see, rather than just go in and, you know, science says we do it this way.
Well, also in that same book, though, John, there are other articles and other chapters by individuals who talk about teaching science with an Indian or an American Indian perspective, you know, science or math. I mean, a lot of Native people obviously understood geometry. You know, if you look at their houses and their dwellings and understanding math in terms of counting and sacred numbers and you know, geology, there's stories about rocks and formation of rocks and such. And so Native people traditionally had stories like that can be utilized in science classes and math classes and studying of herbs and plants, and you know, that you can translate that to botany. And so there are a lot of, you know, it's like John said, a teacher has to want to go out and find that information.
Does a listener have a follow-up?
No, very interesting. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener on line 2 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. I wanted to get an opinion from the two guests about the Chief Illiniwek controversy in Urbana at the University of Illinois.
Are our guests aware of the controversy?
I'm familiar with it.
Okay.
You know, the Stanford University, where it used to be the Indians and now they're Cardinals, it's mixed. I was out there in Chicago and talking to an American Indian, and they didn't see a problem with that. There's a number that do see a problem with it. The Atlanta Braves are a good example, or the Washington Redskins. I sort of feel that we should be moving away from those stereotypes. I think that they tend to be damaging, stereotypical portrayals of American Indians, and you know, I wouldn't want my university to do that to any group.
Well, I'm familiar with it too, and I taught at the University of North Dakota, where they had the Fighting Sioux, and it's really tough to get rid of that kind of stereotypic image. And I'm Dakota Sioux. Even the word Sioux, I can't seem to get rid of, because it's not what we call ourselves. And I was at Dartmouth College when they got rid of the Indian there. And the reason that symbol was taken away was because the alumni used the Native caricature in an abusive fashion. And that's what happens when you start using Native images as caricatures, and they stereotypically, people abuse them. It's just like the tomahawk chop. That's not the way Indian people, you know, sing. It's not the way they beat the drum. And yet, you know, why is it accepted as okay? And when it's really abusive. So I agree with John. It's when you start using it negatively or to make fun of a people, then it isn't appropriate. And why do we do it? Why do Native people have to be the only ones that do that? You know, so, well, we've got the Fighting Irish. I go, oh, great. You know, use the Irish. See how long that lasts. The Frito Bandito didn't last very long, and neither did Little Black Sambo. So why is it okay to do that to the indigenous people of this country?
Caller in Urbana?
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. American Indian education, our topic this afternoon. John Rayner and Jeannie Eder are our guests today. They are the authors of American Indian Education, A History. Are there individuals in this history, this long history that stretches 500 years more, that that you admire? Is there somebody you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, tell us about this afternoon? What would you like to say about
them?
Oh, so
many.
Yeah.
Samson Ockham, who raised the money to found Dartmouth. And, of course, they misused the money because it was supposed to educate more Indians than they did. Charles Eastman, who didn't start school to 16, spoke no English and became a medical doctor. Suzette LaFleche that became a medical doctor. They're sisters, and they were both very... Susan LaFleche, I think, is the one. All through the... I mentioned Polengasi Kwayawama, who went off to school and came back and to be a teacher and used some methodologies originally against the rules of the school to try to make the education, her teaching, relevant to her Hopi children that she was teaching. And I'm sure Jeannie can come up with just any number.
Oh, yeah, there's just a ton of them.
Yeah. That was so inspiring about this history, because along with plenty of villains, there are some wonderful, wonderful people in the story. Jeannie, you want to tell us about a couple of your favorites?
Well, I like the ones that John mentioned. I'm trying to think of some too. John Collier and his movement for positive issues in Native education.
Yeah, that was
you
a big
find
step
that
forward.
Every 20 years, the policy against Indians changes from negative to positive. So every time there is a Democratic administration, there seems to be a lot of social movement and positive things for Native education, and versus the Republicans' movement seem to want to tear down and assimilate and go back to the cultural genocide policies. And that's a big issue when you look at the Republican National Convention today. I mean, where are the Native people?
Of course, George Bush, the father, signed the Native American Language Act.
Yeah, I was going to mention him, too.
Richard Nixon signed the 1972 Indian Education Act. So we need to be very careful about it. You know, it's not the good against the bad. You know, we paint some missionaries that did some very negative things in this book, but there are other missionaries that were very culturally sensitive and wrote literally thousands of letters to get Indians allotments and stuff so they didn't lose their land, and were the leading voices and standing up for the rights of American Indians. So it's one of the things is, in some of the stuff you get, all Indian education was kids getting washed, their mouths washed out with soap in the schools for speaking their Indian languages. And that did happen. But there's a whole other side that we tried to put into this book of where, you know, caring teachers went out of their way to help kids, that politicians like John Collier dedicated their life to, not really a politician, he was the Commissioner of Indian Affairs for about 13 years under Franklin Roosevelt, but they dedicated their life to what they perceived as trying to help American Indians, and you know, some people disagreed with some of the things they did, but, you know, it's hard for me to not see that their hearts were in the right place. So it's a mixed bag, and it's all both sides, you know, if you look at Republicans or Democrats or missionaries versus non-missionaries, it's not black and white. It's a very mixed bag of where individuals stood up and did great things or didn't.
And of course, I'm coming from the area where I was born and raised on a Native reservation and where I went to Indian schools. And, you know, got threatened to be whipped by the principals. And, you know, so, but it was a good teacher that kept me going. So, you know, I agree with John. It's kind of a mixed bag. You have the good with the bad, and you have to learn to somehow find your warrior spirit in all of this and keep on going.
Well, there we'll leave it. I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us this afternoon. Jeannie Eder and John Rayner, authors of American Indian Education, A History. The book is published by the University of Oklahoma Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the board this afternoon, futures were mostly higher, just one loser, as we'll report them this afternoon, that down in the nearby September bean meal. But the rest of the trade was higher for the day, including the wheat pit, where the September contract had a high today of 310 and a quarter, a low at 303 and a half, and a settlement price at 309 and three quarters. They were up 6.5 cents. December futures finished the day 6.5 higher as well, had a high today of 323, a low at 316 and a quarter, and a settlement price at 322 and three quarters. March wheat, 333 and a half on the high, the low at 327, settled at 333, up 5 1/4, and the May contract, 337 and a half, the high, the low at 332 and a half, and a settlement price at 337 and a quarter, up 5 3/4 on the day. July futures in the wheat pit, 340 the high, the low at 335, and a settlement price at 339 and a half, and they finished the day 5.5 cents higher for the day. From the corn pit, the trade for the nearby September was like this, 228 on the high, the low at 223 and a quarter, settlement price at 227 and 3/4, up 3 1/4 for the day. December futures, a 238 high, low at 233 and a quarter, settled at 237 and 3/4, and they finished 2.5 cents higher. March contract now for the corn pit, 245 and 3/4, the high, the low at 241 and a half, and a settlement price at 245 and a quarter for the March contract, a penny and 3/4 higher on the day. May futures, 252 high, low at 247, settled at 251 and 3/4, up 2 1/4 in July corn. 256 and 3/4, the high, the low at 251 and 3/4, settlement price there at 256 and a half, and they finished up 2.5 cents. September corn for next year, 260 the high, the low at 255 and a half, and a settlement price at 259 and a half. Next year, September contract up 3.5 cents. September oats, 150 the high, the low at 142 and a half, a settlement price at 143 and 3/4, settled up 1 1/4, and the December contract, 154 and 3/4, the high, the low at 149 and 1/2, settled 152, and they finished the day a penny and a half higher. September beans from the soy complex now, 628 the high, the low at 616, settled 627 and a quarter. They were up 4 3/4 for the day. November's, 628 the high there, 612 the low. Settlement price the same as the September's at 627 and a quarter. They were, though, up 6 3/4. January beans, 634 the high, the low at 617 and a half, a settlement at 633, 7.5 cents higher. In the March futures, 639 and a half high, low at 625, settled 638 and a half, up 7 1/4 for the day. May soybeans, 640 the high, the low at 628. Settlement price for the May futures at 639 and 3/4, up 7 3/4. In July next year, 645 the high, the low at 631. Settlement for the July bean futures, 6.5 cents higher at 644. Soybean meal, September contract, the only loser here today, 183.10 the high, the low at 179. Settled 180.80. They were down 190. The October contract finished 80 cents higher. They settled at 180 even, had a low of 175 and a high of 180.70. September bean oil now, 26.15 the high, the low at 25.41, settled at 26.10. They were up 69 for the day. And the October bean oil, 25.53 the high, the low at 24.95, but settlement price at 25.48, and they finished 47 higher. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Feeder cattle were lower today. Live cattle and lean hogs finished higher. September feeder cattle, 112.90 the high, 111.52 and a half the low. The settlement, 112.40, that down 95. October, 109.75 the high, 108.50 the low, 109.42 and a half the settlement, that down 62 and a half. November, 108.60 the high, 107.40 the low, 108.42 and a half the settlement, that down 67 and a half. August live cattle, 84.45 the high, 83.55 the low, finishing at 84.22 and a half, up 10. October live cattle, 84.75 the high, 83.02 and a half the low, the settlement 84.65, that up 22 and a half. October lean hogs, 66.05 the high, 64.70 the low, the settlement 65.97 and a half, that up 95. December, 63.85 the high, 62.65 the low, the settlement 63.72 and a half, that up 82 and a half. February lean hog, 62.60 the high, 61.37 and a half the low, 62.50 the settlement, that up 92 and a half. And April lean hog, 61.65 the high, the low 60.60, the settlement 61.50, up 72 and a half. February bellies, 93.60 the high, the low 92.02 and a half, the settlement 92.42 and a half, that down 102 and a half. The Dow is up 15 points at 10,137, the NASDAQ off 5 points at 1832, the S&P 500 up 1 and a fraction at 1101.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life. The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
J.B. Finley from Americus, Georgia writes, Dear Dr. Science, I somewhat understand the formula for calculating a planet's internal differentiated density, but how did this formula come to be when we can't go to other planets?
You've touched upon the very nature of astrophysics. From the most minuscule data, we're able to deduce an amazing number of properties of these distant objects, including favorite color, approximate fragrance, and whether it was Yoko or Paul who really did in the Beatles. You see, everything's connected through invisible threads of causality, which can only be detected by a sensitive intuitive like myself. As a last resort, you could simply search the internet and find out what 50,000 high school students have to say on the subject.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.